go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. You can simply go to Amazon.com, search The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find the second edition there, as well as the Kindle version. The audiobook is going to be released sometime in June. Sometime in June, I will have the audiobook of the second edition available as well. My guest today on the podcast, he was the vision behind a lot of the parkour, lived it, and then built a vision from that into other things, something that just pulls at my heartstrings from being a kid, a nature child myself, but the founder of Evolve, Move, Play, go check it out, which I'm a huge fan of this. I love it, is on the show. Rafe. Man, I knew I was going to mess it up. You know, I was talking slow on purpose going, what'd he say? I've been saying it wrong the whole time in my head for like a, I mean, it'd been booked for about a month or so. So I got to kind of look up a lot of stuff. So I'm glad you set me straight though.
No worries.
I tend to do that for some reason, man. I need to start putting a disclaimer. It's like, look, I have a public school education. I was taught to spell phonetically and sound out and then add what I think is probably wrong to it. So disclaimer for all those, man. But thanks for coming on the show, man, and talking about what you do.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I was reading. I love the interesting story, man, of how you take it back on your website about when you were a kid and how it moved to it. But I'd like to kind of hear from you, man, where you came from, what your road was, if you will, to what you do now.
Yeah, so I grew up on the end of a dirt road and on a piece of property my family homesteaded in 1906 in the Skagit Valley here in the Pacific Northwest. My dad was part of the counterculture. He was kind of a hippie. My parents were. And so I had a lot of freedom to roam the woods as a kid. A lot of kind of interesting experiences, interesting people moving around in my community. A lot of opportunity to see a very broad realm of experience. I had ADHD and dyslexia. And so I was very bright in certain ways and like reading novels in third grade. But at the same time, I was on standardized tests. I was essentially failing out. They couldn't advance me further in school based on my testing. So after third grade, I was taken out of school and I was taken under the wing of a mentor who lived next door, who rented one of the houses on the property that we owned. And he kind of really helped me work through all the anger that I'd built up because of, you know, being stuck in a school system that really didn't work for somebody like me, and having, you know, somewhat of a fraught relationship with my dad, who, you know, is a brilliant guy and someone I've learned a lot from. But, you know, he had a hard time having a son who had some of the learning disabilities he had had, and, you know, all those things. So I had a lot of anger to work out. And my mentor roughhoused with me a lot and gave me an opportunity to do that. And I ran around in the woods and kind of was very physically active as a child. And then I started martial arts when I was 6 years old. So 8 years old, I started homeschooling, but 6 years old, I started martial arts. And I did those off and on throughout my childhood. Developed an interest in physical culture very early of various types. Got really into the Olympics in 1996. Started doing some gymnastics training. Then I was 6 foot two, but not filled out yet. I was very lanky. I was 150 pounds. So gymnastics was quite hard for me initially. My older brother, who's 19 at the time and 5'7 and 140 pounds, he was doing double backflips on trampoline in a couple months and muscle ups. And I was just not able to do any of this stuff. So I got frustrated and I kind of stopped taking classes, but I kept doing the open gyms for a while. And then when I was 18, I came back and I filled out a little bit and I started kind of progressing at gymnastics and got really into it and eventually started teaching when I was 21. Same time I started Muay Thai and BJJ when I was 15, got really into those. Kind of my school shut down, but I kept practicing anytime I got a chance. Then 23, I discovered parkour, became one of the first generation of parkour athletes in the United States. Ended up co-founding the first parkour gym on the West Coast, Parkour Visions. And kind of as soon as I discovered parkour, I was like, there was something in gymnastics that I was really, really intrigued by that really just made me happy kind of overcoming these different challenges. But when I saw parkour, it felt like the scales had been lifted off my eyes. It felt like I'd seen something. I'd seen the same thing as what was attractive to me in gymnastics, but I'd seen it at a deeper level. It's like parkour was this more primal representation of the same thing that was beautiful about gymnastics. And when I saw that, it automatically kind of took me back to being a child and reading all these heroic myths, reading about Achilles and Sigurd the Volsung and Cuchulainn and Aragorn and, you know, Paul Atreides.
The epic journey of the hero.
Exactly. And I remember having this profound sense of disenchantment with the world when I was about 13 years old. And I realized that, like, there were no more dragons. Like, there was nothing enchanting about the world. There was no heroic journey available. And at the time, I decided I was going to be a fantasy author. That was my first professional ambition. And when I discovered parkour, it was as if someone had said, no, there is heroic things left in this world. There are dragons that you can conquer. And the biggest dragons are within yourself. And when you take on a practice like this, then you get to grow. You get to experience your own heroism and you become strong through that. And right away, I thought parkour was like, it was such a big piece of what we were missing, but it wasn't the whole thing. And for me, it was like, if I wanted to be this person that parkour opened my eyes to, I had to have martial arts as well. And I had to lift weights and I had to do these other things. And so I started conceiving in the first few months of doing parkour, I started conceiving this idea of a general human physical practice. This idea of what were the heroic skills that defined Achilles, that defined Sigurd, that defined all these heroic characters that I've been so obsessed with. It was some combination of parkour and martial arts and gymnastics and strength and conditioning, like something in there. If you could be all those things, then you're going to be really following the heroic journey. Was that idea that I had then, and I called it warrior arts initially. So I then came into contact with the work of Georges Hébert, the Natural Method. He had developed a kind of complete approach to physical culture in the early 20th century. And he talked about, you know, 10 primary physical capacities that you needed to have. You'd be able to walk, run, jump, move on all fours, climb, swim, balance, lift, throw, and swim. Or I said swim, and defend yourself. And you are competent to the degree that you had competency across all of these categories. So I became really interested in that and started kind of orienting my training towards some of these méthode naturelle ideas. I ran into Erwin LaCour, who went on to found MoveNet, and we were communicating a lot and kind of working together on developing these concepts in 2006, 2007. Originally, the idea was to essentially revive méthode naturelle. But it was an interesting experience for me because, you know, all the original méthode naturelle literature is in French, and it's not even in modern French. There's been a lot of change in French. It's difficult for French speakers even to read some of that, or at least that's what Erwin told me. So he wouldn't let me look at the books, and he wouldn't give them to me. So everything was sort of sifted through his experience, and then I was interacting with the parkour community, and I was training with my local MMA gym. I was training under the SBG system, Straight Blast Gym. And so I was kind of experimenting and doing my own thing. And so I kind of had all my own thoughts about it and all my own kind of approach and stuff that I was getting out of the parkour community. And I also ran into the work of Frank Ferencich of Exuberant Animal and communicated with him and got some very interesting ideas about the importance of play, which was really important to me, and tapped into these ideas around roughhousing that was important to me from my childhood. So I had all that kind of gestating my head, and, you know, Erwin and I, we just couldn't kind of make it work as a team. We couldn't figure that out. So eventually I was like, well, you know, you go your way, I'll go mine. But one of the things that we had a conflict over was that I felt like, I honestly felt like we were neither of us good enough at the things that we were trying to do yet, right? Like, to create a general model of how a human being should be physically, it wasn't enough to be a novice in each of the things that we were trying to talk about. It's like you had to pick something and go down the path towards physical mastery. And for me, it was obvious that the thing that I was most attracted to and the thing that I had the best opportunity really to go deeply into and have a really good support network was the parkour community. So I went and I co-founded Parkour Visions, and I spent, you know, 4 or 5 years kind of really devoted to parkour. And then I reached a point where I found myself kind of increasingly disenchanted with the direction of what parkour was becoming. That it had started very broad, and people were talking about it. It's swimming parkour, or it, you know, can you look at another human being and fighting as a martial artist parkour? There are people used to train in nature. In the early days of parkour, there was lots of training in nature, actually, with the Yamakaze. But now it's like everyone talked about urban obstacle coursing, and there was flips, and people were moving into the gyms. And I had started a gym, but I didn't want to be training in the gym, and I wanted everyone I trained with to be outside, and that just wasn't happening. And there was internal conflicts as well at the gym, and just decided it was time to go and time to kind of really articulate what my vision was and teach that to people and to have, you know, create my own sandbox to play in, basically. So I did that, and I walked away from the parkour gym, and I, you know, 3 months later I had Evolve Move Play, the website up and running, and had my first seminars booked, and was kind of offering the best synthesis of all the different strands of physical culture that I had invested in, that I had cultivated, that I had studied as one thing. And then over the last 4 years, I've been refining that and sifting it and adding material and studying more things as well. So that's kind of the story of how Evolve Move Play came to be.
Well, essentially, you evolved. The story of evolving from, you know, your basic interest, even from your childhood, and being able to snap back where you found freedom from the pressures of the outside life, etc. And I like how you put all that together, but even in your name, to continue to evolve, to grow, to move into something. If you could, walk me back through the parkour culture a little bit, the emergence of it, what it really meant, how it came to be really, and maybe the spread of it, the different paths that went down, et cetera.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. It's not. So I can talk, you know, with fair authority about what's happened in the United States. But if we go back to the history of parkour in France, which is where it started, there's a lot of conflicting stories. it's an interesting story, I think. I think it's worth sharing, but just take it with a grain of salt, what I have to say, because, you know, I've only met one of the nine guys who founded the discipline, or, you know, nine-ish guys who founded the discipline, and only briefly. I've trained with Stefan Vigru and spent a week with him. He was one of David Bell's students. So I've heard those stories, and then I've heard stories, you know, through the things. But essentially, you can kind of view parkour as a story that revolves around two families, the Hinatra family and the Bell family. So David Bell is widely credited as the founder of parkour, which is true in a sense because he gave it a specific name. But what he gave a name to was a practice that had been growing out of the experience of this community of cousins and friends since, you know, their early teens at least. And I'm not even sure they can precisely articulate what they were trying to do originally. I don't think they knew what they were trying to do. They were playing games like kids, and they were seeking something. I would say that the easiest thing to say about it is they were trying to discover what it meant to be strong men. And the Bell family, so David's father, Raymond Bell, was from, the Bell family's from Vietnam. David's father, Raymond, had apparently served as a child soldier in the Franco-Vietnamese War on the French side. So he had perhaps been educated in méthode naturelle. That was a major part of the French military at the time. There are stories about him kind of training to move through trees and do crazy acrobatics in the trees. And he eventually became one of the military firefighters in Paris. And one of the ways that he trained himself was to jump between rooftops because he was a helicopter jumper. He would be dropped out of helicopters into fire, into burning buildings. And so the story is that he was one of the first ones to start this practice of building jumping as a way to prepare his mind to deal with this. Mm. So David was not raised by his father. He met him off and on, but he was also in contact with his cousins and various people on that side of the family. So then, his cousin Chow, so he had three cousins who are kind of big in the story of the parkour, Fung, Chow, and Williams. And Fung eventually dropped out, but Williams and Chow are still kind of involved in what's going on, or very involved in what's going on, I should say. Fung was the eldest. He was the closest to David in age. So their father, so if I remember the story correctly, and you can read a book called Breaking the Jump by Julie Angel to get a better understanding of it, but I believe he was a martial artist and perhaps involved in circus performance as well. So there was this very strong culture of physical capacity in that family on both sides. And he also, I think, had a military background, and there was a lot of harsh physical discipline. There was a lot of, you know, cultural conflict, I think, between those kids and the older generation. I don't remember the name of the father of Williams and Chow, but in any event, they had this rich background of gymnastics and méthode naturelle or something like it that they had been educated in, and Viet Vo Dao, Vietnamese Kung Fu, that was sort of wrapped into their upbringing. And they also were, you know, really into Jackie Chan films and Dragon Ball Z and all the stuff that was going on there. And they just kind of, they had this drive to discover how to be strong. So they were out, you know, like we associate parkour with jumps and flips, but they were out there doing, you know, 1,000 push-ups in a day. And they were lifting, you know, trying to find big rocks to lift and move them around. And they were training fighting. So David met Jan Hinatra at some point, I think, you know, when they were in their mid-teens. And Jan was from New Caledonia, which is a Melanesian or Micronesian island, I believe. And his family apparently came from, like, old warriors. You know, they had this strong idea of being a warrior as well. So there's something that they really had in common. And when those two got together and started kind of hanging out, It was like every time they hung out, it was like, let's see if we can jump from here to there. Let's see, you know, see who can take a punch in the stomach. Let's hang each other by our ankles off this building and just test how strong we are. And it was that kind of, you know, I actually think that, that the kind of the story of parkour, it's a little bit like Fight Club. You know, it's, there was something, and I think people don't realize this, but there's a lot of people who are like, we're kind of doing parkour even before it became a thing. There's lots of like this bubbling up of people, of young men seeking a way to challenge themselves, young women too, but more so young men.
I had no idea it had such a rich history like this. Like, I'm just sitting back like, holy shit. Because the way it kind of has been sold to a lot of people is a bunch of crazy teenagers jumping around on buildings and doing flips, like you said. And hearing the rich history of anything, I for the most part, I enjoy. And listening to how it evolved and then how you're talking, there was a thing I did. I played high school football, and I was never the fastest or biggest or anything, but I had to work really hard. Yeah. And one of the things I'd love to do on spring or summer ball, sometimes after practices or whatever, is I grew up in the woods hunting, camping, you know, that kind of stuff. I would literally just run as fast as I possibly could through the woods and try not to get killed, you know, try not to trip or slip or do anything. And eventually a couple guys would start to join me too. There'd be linemen out there, running backs out there, and just sprinting through it as fast as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, funny thing about my personal story about parkour is that my older brother showed me a video of David Bell, and that's how I got turned on to the idea of parkour. And I looked up his name. I looked up David Bell on Yahoo or whatever it was before.
AOL.
Something. I looked up his name, and I found a website called leparkour.net. And that was the first time that I kind of realized that this wasn't just this one amazing stuntman. This was like this idea of a discipline that people were engaged in. And that was really intriguing to me. And I immediately kind of wanted to do it, but I was actually too afraid to start it on my own.
I would be too. I mean, you gotta, I don't know, anytime I watch gymnastics or gymnasts do their thing, I always look and go, well, they had to fall a lot of times before the first one. And I'm looking at the balance beam going, nah, I don't think I'm risking that fall, you know? And, it's so structured like that. So when you say scary, when it's not just jumping over a pipe, you know what I mean? You risk life and limb, man.
Absolutely. So I wasn't ready to start on my own. I just started like walking on rails and stuff, but I wasn't doing any jumps. I wasn't really like really trying the skills out, but there was a guy who came to the adult gymnastics classes that I taught. His name was Dane. And he was sort of always doing these creepy things. He was dive rolling over blocks and swinging on the rings and jumping off to the bars and swinging from bar to bar.
He's doing like the Ace Ventura Pet Detective, doing the down set.
Doing the type of thing that parkour guys do when they go into to gyms. But he didn't know what parkour was. But I was like, hey, man, check this thing out. You'd probably be really into it. You probably want to try it. And so he went and watched a video of it. And then he walked into the gymnastics office and asked for my number and then called me and said, hey, like, let's do this. Like, come out and train with me. And I was like, well, you know, he's kind of like out of the blue. I didn't know the guy that well, really. And
you call it. You're like, well, you knew it was coming.
And so I was like, okay, well, I need to finish finals. And then, sure, let's go out and we'll do it. So he took me out. And the thing was, he already, like, had a bunch of jumps and a bunch of climbs that he developed all around town before he ever knew about parkour. And he'd been doing something kind of parkour-like since he was a kid. Like, he'd always been doing this stuff. And so...
It's like this innate thing, right? And everybody listening to, you know, you do it when you're walking by and you think you can jump up and slap that sign. Yeah, everyone does it. You see them walk by, you kind of go, ugh, everyone gets the jump to try to slap something. It's like this innate behavior in us, right?
Yeah. Kids everywhere climb and jump and run and vault. It's just natural human behavior. So they were doing it. Another really interesting story about this is if you want to see the best parkour video ever, in my opinion, it's a video called Out of Time by Oleg Borislav. Oleg is from Latvia. He's a Russian guy from Latvia. And so far as I understand the story, again, this is not my story, so it's just hearsay, but it's interesting if it's true. Oleg was another one of these guys who was just doing this stuff. he just was obsessed with this playground that he lived nearby and was constantly jumping and swinging and playing on it and developing all these really high-level movement skills and flipping. And then there was a parkour scene that developed in Dvinsk, in the town that he lived in. And they basically ran into him and saw him as doing parkour, but he was just doing the thing that he'd always been doing. And there was kind of like, you could like see that there's sort of this bubbling up of this basic underlying physical need for human beings to move this way. But it was something, there was a cultural sort of, it caught fire, if that makes sense. It's like there's sparks everywhere, but there was enough tinder in this one group of kids in France that they made something out of it together that was bigger and more powerful than anything else. And when people saw it, it went crazy. And that's kind of a way to think about it. So that's sort of the story of how parkour.
I love that idea, man. Maybe it's because it's recess again, right? Maybe it's playground, right? When you're bonding with somebody, when, I don't know, we lift the veil. Like, why can't I play on the playground? You know what I mean? Sometimes the playgrounds they built now, they're not toxic and shit where we were getting sick playing on them. Now they're like all these cool, awesome abstractions, right? And I'm like, I'm going to go be a hamster for a little bit, right? And go mess around. And then, but for some reason, right? Society kind of, well, we can't play anymore, right? We can't go on the trampoline anymore. We can't run outside at this. This something happens, right? But when we do it, you know, and share that with somebody, there's like this release. Like we've agreed that we can take off the mask and no one's going to say anything. And we feel so free and childlike again.
An interesting thing to understand about a human being is that a human being is the most playful animal in the world, right? Like all young animals play, and they play in ways that are specific to their species. They play predominantly, or they play with the skills that are necessary for them. So if you watch a puppy, right, what kind of games do puppies like to play?
Grace bites, chews, rolls around, races, runs, catches. She plays Frisbee.
So they like, puppies in particular love games of chase and tag. They like to wrestle and roughhouse. They like to bite things and like to take things apart with their teeth. So essentially, they're replicating the skills that a wolf needs to survive, right? Dogs are descended from wolves. So what does a wolf do? A wolf is a pursuit predator. Wolves mostly don't ambush. They walk up to the prey and they kind of test them and they try to get them to run. And when they run, they chase them. And the wolves, they like nothing better than chasing something. And then they usually grab the back of the leg. They hamstring the animal. They grab the back leg with their teeth. They try to rip the back leg until the animal can't run, and then they pile on and they drag the animal to the ground, and then they rip its entrails out and eat it. So that's how a wolf catches its prey. So puppies play in ways that's specific to their evolutionary niche. If you think about a cat, they love to stalk and pounce and bite and grapple with things. Well, that's what a cat does. So if you look at any animal, the way that it plays, it's sort of a guide to the things that it needs to be able to survive and reproduce. So how do little human children play in every culture in the world? Because humans are unique, right? We're the most cultural animals, so there's elements of our play that are going to be unique, right? Like Game Boys are not a universal aspect of human play. But
sarcasm.
but kids are inherently attracted to climbing, especially trees, right? They love to jump from one point to another. They love to roughhouse with each other. They love to throw things. They love to fight with sticks, right? They love to build things. And of course, they love to engage in like imaginary play and social play, because all those things are really important aspects of how we survive as a human being. So we do this, and that's how we build ourselves, is through play. And the interesting thing about this is that we do this more than any other species. And we are more reliant on it than the other species because our brains are so flexible. So much more of our behavior is not preset. We actually have to essentially to develop competence in something, you have to play with it as a human being.
You got to experience it.
And we're the most cognitively flexible animal. We can think in ways another animal can think. We can create novel patterns in our brain more than the other animal can. And it's play that's actually the best thing that allows us to maintain that behavioral flexibility. So there's some studies now of people called superagers, people who basically have brains that look like 20-year-olds in their 70s. And what they find is the kind of the fundamental characteristic of these people is that they're constantly learning new things. So our drive to learn, to explore, and to play, it's all very tightly connected. And it's one of the defining characteristics of our species. But it makes us hard to handle. That's kind of the fundamental thing. Like you think about like kids when they're playing, like they're chaotic. They're out of control. They drive adults crazy. And I think that our society, it's like, it kind of, you know, we're threatened by people who play. We're threatened by people who explore new things. They're destabilizing the social order in a way. So we want to tamp that down. We want to control that. And we start with kids because it's, you know, the way that we evolved, if we look at hunter forager societies in general, you'll see this consistent pattern. At 4 years old, a child essentially becomes independent of its mother most of the time. So it still depends on her for food and for comfort and sleeps next to her, but it spends most of its time actually with other children. At 4 years old to 12 years old, kids are part of a play group, and all they do is play all day. And that's their normal education. That's how children educate themselves. They go out and they model the things that they see, and their play is them modeling what they see. So if you need to climb trees in their culture to say get honey or hunt or everything, then they're climbing trees a lot, and they're pretending to be the best guy in the village who climbs trees and gets honey. And they're pretending to hunt, and they're pretending to be a mom. They're pretending to do all these things. And through that, they self-educate in the skills that are relevant to their culture. So we've done something really weird. We've taken kids at 5 years old, 6 years old, and we've put them in chairs. And we force them to sit still. And we punish them for playing. And I mean, that just goes all the way up. It's like our education system, it was developed in order to create factory workers. That's what they want. That's what they want. They is such a terrible, vague term,
The system is organized to do exactly what you're saying.
Organized around this idea of how do we make economically efficient value producers in a incredibly inhumane setting, because factory work is so far from the way that humans evolved to behave. And we're trying to manipulate ourselves to be able to handle that, trying to educate children. The problem is that it's out of date. We're not factory workers anymore.
Insert mental health issues. Rise of mental health issues across the country. We see emergence of all different types, kinds, severities, diagnoses, books, experiences. I write in my book about if you're feeling depression and anxiety, it's a good thing, but it's your mind and body trying to say, get me the fuck out of here. Yeah. Change something, do something. And I think you're right on point with this idea of we're fitting we're trying to force ourselves into this unnatural, structured play. And I mean, what, play dates? Like, what the fuck is a play date, right? In this organized structure way from our kids on up, that this is how we function. Like you said, we become producers, not alive human beings, man. And I think this is, you're right on point, man. I would agree from a therapist side, right? I mean, you ask why opiate addiction, what, 91 people die? It's almost more than car crashes now. I think it may be. We have all of these, what the fuck's happening to people mentally going on? Well, you get disturbances in the force, man, when you start naturally pulling away from what we almost evolved to do and where we find our happiness, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, you can model parkour and a lot of these movement arts, the explosion of them is it's sort of like it's people trying to reclaim something that they intrinsically recognize on a deep level is important to them. And I think, particularly, you know, if you look at the people who found parkour communities, you find a lot of them have ADHD. A lot of them are, you know, learning disabled in some way, or, you know, cognitively a little bit different. And I think you can, to me, ADHD should probably just be called, you know, movement deprivation syndrome. You know, I think there's a bell curve. There's a normal distribution of, say, need for movement in a child. Some children are highly driven to move. Some are much more tolerant of kind of like a low movement lifestyle. And I think that our current education system is incredibly punishing for people who have a high need to move.
Well, so is the real world, because what follows that is medication, chemical incarceration, disability checks. The belief that you're abnormal begins to set into people, when truly what we're doing really is not normal, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I can't remember the exact statistics. It's really some sort of shocking number. It's like 1 in 10 or 1 in 5 boys. I think it's actually like 1 in 5 boys in this country now is on Ritalin or Adderall. Right. We've pathologized. So boys need movement. Boys tend to be a little bit more driven towards movement than girls, and particularly towards rough and tumble play. Across every culture that we can look at, boys engage in more wrestling, more boxing, more stick fighting, more jumping off of things than girls. That's not to say that girls don't do those things, don't enjoy those things, or don't benefit from those things.
Yeah, you can get those emails, man, not me.
It's just that the boys tend to kind of need a little bit more of it. You know, like with my kids, I have a 4.5-year-old daughter and a 2.5-year-old boy. It's like, she wants to roughhouse every day. He wants to roughhouse every day, but she's done after like 10 minutes. And a lot of times, like, there is no done. Like, he pretty much is willing to go until he falls asleep. And that's a fairly typical experience. So there's a little bit of a difference there. So when you get into the outliers, when you get into sort of the people who are the most highly driven, you find a lot of them are boys. And what we're doing is we're essentially saying that is pathological, right? If we say, like, you know, if the normal boy is like the 50th percentile for movement, say like maybe at the 75th percentile for movement, we're now defining as a pathology. It's just a normal part of the distribution, but it's a pathology. And now we have to drug them just to keep them alive in the system. And the drugs that we're giving them, Adderall is in the same chemical class as cocaine. I mean, it's insane. We're giving basically cocaine to 6-year-olds.
It's meth. It's basically methamphetamine on a chemical. I mean, Dr. Carl Hart has mentioned that many times, even on this podcast. It's correlation to methamphetamine. But like you said, that bell curve, and when it becomes a pathology, it becomes dangerous when we judge what's normal. And well, what you hear from a lot of parents, though, that back up or believe in it, is the first thing they'll say is, well, his or her grades improved, and this is what's happening now. And I'm saying yes, because they are now more conformed to fit to the system rather than be themselves as the individual. And the response to it should not, in my opinion, be better performance within a structured system, but yet an interpersonal feeling of happiness and focus and acceptance of the environment around that child, and ways to apply those strengths. Because many times those things looked at as a pathology are a fucking strength and can be used to develop other things, be creative, invent things. I mean, it can be amazing when we try to straddle and harness and cattle everyone into a median. I think is where we start to pop up more mental health diagnoses.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is we need those people. The creativity, if you do an index of creativity, so I'm really influenced right now by the work of a personality psychologist, Jordan Peterson. I was recently watching some of his stuff. One of the things he's talking about is if you index creativity, and basically you can test people on how many ways they can imagine using anything, right? Here's a brick. What can you do with it? People who come up with more solutions are more creative, and they tend to be more creative across many different fields of creativity. The interesting thing about those people is that the correlation between creativity and academic success is zero, or it's negative. And that's probably true, not just of academic success, but it's probably true of like being successful in the average corporation, right? If you're a middle manager in, you know, you know, X Corp America, they don't want you to be creative, or they can't recognize creativity. They can't reward creativity, and the only time that they're going to notice that you're creative is when you break something.
Well, when you come outside the system, I did a post a while ago, and I called dress code at employment as blackmail and extortion. And just looking at it on a physical level, if you can't wear that, and you can't wear this, and this can't be here, I mean, that's conformity on a whole nother level. That's extortion, if you ask me. But I always point out that there's always, though, something magical about Friday. You can wear jeans on Friday for some weird reason. The social stigma of my slacks or my jeans lifts on the Friday, right? It's fucking crazy conformity, man, and it's extortion.
Yeah, well, I live on the West Coast, so, you know, in the tech center, people wear jeans and T-shirts every day. But
well, look where they're at. It's more of an advanced science, right? An advanced area of business, right? I'm not manufacturing, you know, in a plant or something like that per se.
Or another way to look at it is that that those cultures have been more recently founded by creative people, because that's what creative people do, right? The school system, it's not designed for creative people. It's designed to create factory workers, right? But you need creative people. Creative people are the people who create solutions to problems that we haven't yet solved. And so they're incredibly valuable. And right now, we're not only terrible at recognizing them, we're probably actively destroying their capacity to create by doing things like taking these kids who are 6 years old and putting them on Adderall. That's basically saying, because you can't play a color inside the lines, we're going to shut you down. And now your ability to create something new is also going to be shut down.
I mean, if we looked at people, right, everyone as seeds, et cetera, to grow and evolve our human race and culture, et cetera. And if every child this planet is a seed, before it even grows or develops or evolves or gets to a place, we start pouring chemicals on it. I mean, if people just look at that as a plant, if I just pour chemicals on top of a seedling, I don't know what I'm going to do to it. But yet our best chance of advancement and creativity and new ideas, we are stunting at the baseline of their development with chemicals because they don't fall into some subjective normality.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bad system for sure. And
but what you're doing is bringing that back, though. That's to bring it full circle. What you're doing with Evolve, Move, Play like that is bringing that back, is trying to educate the people on, if you can make the parents at least come in that way, they can help their kids learn that way. So I think what you're doing is almost a way of fighting back against that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, for me, essentially, I'm trying to give people a pathway towards greater meaning in their life through the practice of movement, through understanding themselves through movement, through confronting their own personal demons through movement, through recognizing all the different ways that we can nourish ourselves with this one thing, with movement, and how that will make us the strongest, most adaptable, most resilient human beings that we can be. That's what it is. And I believe that if you make people competent, if you make people strong, if you make people anti-fragile, those people, they're the change, right? I think people are way too reliant on this idea of social change as being like, let's complain until there's some top-down change. And I don't think that works. I think that what works is when people say, the change is in me and the change is in the people around me. And then they find a way to make that work, make that attractive to people, make people want to engage in it, and give people a benefit from it. Right? If you want to do it and you get something really powerful out of it, then that change will tend to move down the chain to other people.
Well, it's bringing the experience to the person, right? We have our beliefs, which are based on what we've experienced, which creates what we think and how we feel. And I think even if you don't want to do what it is you're talking about, I think you have to experience it anyway so you can be actually sure, right? Because if you can't say, I don't like the restaurant, I've never eaten there, right? So to experience it, at least put yourself in something uncomfortable and walk through it and be willing to try something new. I think that experience itself is how we shape new beliefs about how we feel, about what we do to be healthy, to connect. You know, I think it's what you point out. I even write in the book, man, is affecting your proximity. You know, Dr. Carl Hart actually said that too, is affecting our proximity and those around us by what we do. And I think those outliers are also important too. The ones that do reach out, whether it's social media or speak out in some way of the experience, for sure. But I would agree that a global change definitely has to come from within the person in your proximity on a massive scale.
Yeah, I don't know. Forgive me for getting too political here. I want to just go off on a little bit of a rant here.
You can go on a rampage, brother. That's what it's for.
I don't think so. You know, maybe people on the right are happy about Donald Trump, but I don't think they really are. Maybe people on the left are happy about Justin Trudeau in Canada or Emmanuel Macron in France. But I think that if they look deeply at what's going on with any of them, there's nobody in power in the Western world who's an actual admirable character.
Now you got the Labour Party emerging in the UK now after these new votes.
I mean, yeah, okay, Corbyn too, right? Here's a guy who's, been pro-IRA, he's apologizing for terrorism, he's a big fan of communism and stuff. And yet, I have lots of friends who are huge fans of him, and I totally understand because he at least seems to live behind his principles. And it's the same thing with like Bernie Sanders in the United States. And it's like, whatever side of the political spectrum you are on, I think we can all kind of sort of agree that there seems to be a dearth of people who are now kind of in the halls of power, who are people that you can admire as people of virtue, as people of integrity, and people of vision.
I'm trying hard right now. I mean, if you want to say for a wide cast net vision, I mean, Bernie Sanders at least has a curveball to throw out there, but it's still tapped in. But I don't know. Shit, you're right, man. There's probably somebody I'm missing.
But here's the thing. So I was thinking about that, and like we tend to think, okay, well, politics is corrupt. And we look at the problem as external to us. But maybe the problem is, what are we not doing as individuals? What are we not taking on? What are we not facing as individuals that's allowing the system to decay so much that the only people who move through it are the worst people we can imagine? And they may be the worst people on your team or the worst people on the other team, but fundamentally, you don't want to be ruled by the worst.
Keep going.
Worst who are rising to the power over and over again. Maybe what we need to confront is that we have become corrupt as individuals, that we have become weak, that we have become, whether we have lost virtue and character. And that if we focus on becoming strong individually, that we focus on developing our own character, and we focus on creating tribes of people who have character, who have virtue, who have strength, that it's going to be harder for the charlatans. It's going to be harder for the empty suits to convince people anymore, right? It's, if everybody is just looking for something soothing to hear, someone to give them the right promises that they want, and if they're not willing to confront things, if they're not willing to confront the dark on their own side, then it's just going to keep getting worse. And it doesn't come, you don't fix it because your team won this election. You fix this because you start developing yourself as a human being, and the next person follows suit, and you help the next person, you help the next guy, and you keep doing that. And then there's a virtuous cycle, but it's like, it's bottom up. It's not top down. We can't fix it up there. I don't think we have to. If we see that there is this trend towards corruption, this trend towards lack of virtue in our leaders, that should be a signal that there's something we need to confront about ourselves.
I would agree. We could quote V for Vendetta, right? If you look for who to blame, you need only look in the mirror. And the fact that we allow it, right? We have allowed the corruption, but not, but we do. And I think we get focused on our immediate, that we say, okay, I got to take care of mine. This is how it is, right? So we focus on our immediate family, our kids right next to us, right? And we say, this is who I look out for. You even start to look at the other guys going a threat, right? As the family comes around, you start to go, wait, who the fuck, right? Instead of that idea of, for one, I always ask people, I consider myself, if I have to have a label, as a radical politically. But the idea is, like you asked, is the question, do you believe the system in place will fix the system in place? If your answer to that is no, then you're a fucking radical for the most part, too, because it has to change. The system that's is set up with electoral colleges and bullshit representatives, they can change borders of counties anytime they want to. I mean, it's moves. We don't have anything, but the idea, I think we've become apathetic, right? We just say, ah, fuck it, it's corrupt. Who cares, right? And we just go about taking care of the immediate. When truly, if we gave a fuck, really, about our kids and our grandkids and those before us, somebody would fucking do something, right? As a whole, like we would, right? We wouldn't just care about whether they made practice tomorrow, or whether they ate tomorrow. We would be looking, I think, further down the line, man.
Well, think about it. Maybe there's an interesting way to think about it, and it connects back to what I'm trying to do with my work. There's this general, there's this idea, there's a general trend in history that times of ease breed people who are decadent, who are weak, who are not willing to confront the problems that are arising. Because, you know, when you see a problem but it's far away and there's lots of distractions, there's lots of luxuries, there's lots of things to get to take your mind off of it, it's like, well, why bother yourself with it? So it's only when there's something that really pushes us that we learn then to find our virtues in a sense. But that's what makes, I think, parkour or natural movement or martial arts or any of these things actually such powerful practices for people. It's because it's actually a way to seek struggle. I said this in one of my videos. I said, when we seek comfort, we don't find happiness. Right? It's through overcoming ourselves. It's through finding our limits and finding our capacity to overcome them that we find a sense of meaning in ourselves. It's not precisely what I said. It's something like that. It's in my video called The Waterfall. I was listening to a Jordan Peterson video recently, and he said something that was almost exactly the same that I thought was interesting. He said that you don't get happy by seeking safety. Don't get happiness by seeking safety. There is no safety. It's a trap. You become happy by lifting the heaviest thing that you can carry. And you find meaning when you do that. And that we develop meaning through struggle. And what these physical practices are, what we're talking about, what we're doing is we're going out and we're saying, I'm going to find something that I can struggle with. I'm going to find a dragon that I can wrestle with, because in doing that, I will discover who I am and I will develop meaning and I will develop the character that will allow me to build strength in this world. And if we look at, you know, let's be careful with analogies, but people are the physically weakest that we've ever been. We're the physically weakest human beings that we've ever been. And you know, obviously there are people, you know, Stephen Hawking, for instance, not a physically strong person, but he's maybe one of the strongest people in the world. So it's not like strength of body means strength of mind. But maybe there's a correlation there. And maybe if we've let our bodies fall apart, that's an indication that we're at least missing one of the major ways in which we can cultivate strength of character, in which we can cultivate ourselves to have something meaningful. And to be something worthwhile.
Well, that philosophical evidence or rampage, if you will, that cognitive rampage is backed by even biological science. I had the molecular biologist on here, John Joe McFadden, and their research of watching cells have to evolve through conflict, that they have to face an adversity, and through that adversity they develop, they split in two, they appear other places, they find ways around it through the adversity, and almost science proving that in order for our cells to grow, our mentals to grow, that we face that adversity. And I think you're right. In such a distracted world of luxury, of relaxation and non-movement, I think our body and our cells begin to die. We don't face it. And the challenge of flipping off the building the first time or jumping off that is creating that challenge on a mental level, a philosophical, a physical, and a deeper biological level.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, to go back to the anti-fragile, which I mentioned earlier, that's essentially what Nassim Taleb is talking about, right? A biological system or a analogous system, something that behaves like a biological system, it has to be stressed regularly or it becomes weak. It's like there's only one direction. There's no stasis. You can only get stronger or you can get weaker. Stress makes you stronger or it breaks you. But lack of stress just makes you more and more fragile. So you always are looking for a way to essentially to fail or to be stressed enough that you grow without being stressed so much that you break. Mm.
It's hard not to end it on that beautiful rampage, my friend. It's hard not to, man. How can people look you up? Talk about what you do, what you train people with for a little bit. I mean, I love this philosophical and biological journey we've taken talking, man. I didn't expect that deep to go in. I've enjoyed this thoroughly, man. But I want to talk a little bit about how someone works with you, what you do, how you start that out. How do you train someone in running through the woods of the city or something like that? What's incorporated with all that?
Cool. So I teach seminars. I've got seminars coming up around the United States right now. My big one, the best one that people can come to is called Return to the Source. It's July 15th to the 21st. There's only two slots left right now. So if people want to get into it, they need to jump on board like as soon as they hear this podcast. Because
where do they do that at?
EvolveMovePlay.com. That's where you find my work. So what I teach is a combination basically of what I call natural parkour. So it's essentially quite closely related to the movements that you see in the parkour community, only adapted to movement in the natural environment. So there's lots of types of obstacles that we experience or types of challenges that we experience when we go into nature that are not precisely the same as what you experience in the world, in the urban environment. So it's like a closely related martial art in a sense, right? Imagine two martial arts, but they evolve, say, judo and jiu-jitsu. Judo focuses on standing grappling, jiu-jitsu focuses on ground grappling. So they start with the same syllabus, but then they try to solve two different problems and they sort of evolve separately. So I've taken parkour and the practice that I developed there for many, many years, and I've evolved it into how do I climb trees? How do I move up and down slopes? How do I run through the woods? How do I, jump from object to object? How do I move around on big rocks? And so I have developed a whole language around that and how to train people to do that. And it's fascinating to me because that's, urban parkour is beautiful and it's a really great thing. I highly recommend anybody, look up your local parkour community as a way to kind of start your journey in movement. But we didn't evolve to move on flat terrain. We didn't evolve to move on 90 degree angled concrete. And it's much less rich in complexity than the natural environment. So when we take it back to nature, we nourish ourselves with a much broader spectrum of movement. And not only do we nourish ourselves with sort of more variety of movement, we nourish ourselves with the natural world itself, which is inherently good for us, right? There's, when we're interacting with the soil, we're actually interacting with microbes that are what your immune system is supposed to calibrate itself on, or microbes that have antidepressant effects. When we're running around in the trees, we're literally breathing the breath of the trees directly. And there's phytochemicals that come out of trees that have any number of effects that we're just beginning to understand. When we walk through, if you walk through a green space, it has positive effects on your blood pressure, on your hormones, on your sleep, on your willpower, any number of things. You can look up Shorin Ryukyu, which is the Japanese practice of forest bathing. And they've done a bunch of scientific studies now on how that affects you. So if you train in nature, you're going to be getting the same effects, but they're going to be compounded by all the positive physiological effects you get from running, jumping, climbing. One of the ways I like to talk about the benefit of natural movement in nature, as opposed to sort of moving in a gym or moving in the urban environment, is if anyone in your audience has ever trained primarily with barbells or rings or calisthenic bars, they'll know that, you know, after some training, you get a line of callus just underneath your fingers and maybe a little bit kind of in the middle knuckle of your finger. But if they think about it, they'll recognize that the rest of the hand is essentially basically the same as someone who's untrained. It's soft. Now, my hand, if you look at it, I mean, it's so hard to tell, obviously, over this, but essentially it's calloused from the bottom of the palm to the tip of the finger. And there's a little bit of more callus just under the fingers, but the skin next to it is very calloused too and strong. So if you only have the calluses just below your fingers, it actually makes you much more prone to ripping. Because essentially you have highly trained, strong skin next to totally untrained skin. And you have a force coupling problem. Katie Bowman calls this a proportional weakness problem. So when the strong callus skin pulls on the soft skin, that's the mechanism for your rip. The reason that my hand has callus across the whole thing is that the types of surfaces my hand interacts with are extremely diverse, because every tree branch is a different width, it's a different shape, it has different types of textures, a different level of hardness, so it's constantly stressing my hand in different ways. Same thing for the different rocks that I interact with. So I am actually getting a hand that has better integrated strength in the skin, but the skin is just one layer. You can also look at that and say that the same thing's happening in the connective tissue, and the same thing's happening in the muscles. And then you can say that's an analogy for the entire body. When we train in a sort of linear way on, say, a barbell squat, we're creating one line of tension that the body's very good at solving. And so the tissues are getting strengthened specifically in relationship to that line of tension. And the neurological system is becoming stronger and better grooved into that line of tension, and better able to control that line of tension. But you move off that line a little bit, and all of a sudden you have some really strong tissues pulling on tissues that are untrained. Or you have really strong tissues trying to recover from a position that they have very poor motor control of. And that's another mechanism for an injury. So if you think about, you know, you come from a football background, right? Maybe if you're still paying attention to football, you realize that the football players who are coming to the NFL right now, they're the fastest, strongest, most explosive athletes we've ever seen. 46-inch vertical leaps, 12-foot-plus broad jumps recently by Byron Jones. You know, guys who squat 600 pounds. And yet the injury rates in those sports are continuing to rise. They're rising at an incredible rate. I saw the statistic once that the ACL rate had tripled in the last decade or something. I've talked to a good friend of mine, Michael Tankovich, who works for the Seattle Seahawks, and he says it's unlikely that anybody has a really good metric of that, because the teams are really cagey with their data, but it sounds about right to him. Michael Tankovich and Patrick Ward, who's the sports scientist there, they're like, yeah, it's plausible. Let's say it's plausible. They've seen enough of an injury rate that the idea that it's tripled doesn't strike them as implausible. So let's say there's been a very substantial increase in the injury rate. Achilles tendon tears. I remember when Elton Brand tore his Achilles tendon, and that was like a freak injury, something you never saw. It was crazy. Now it seems like I see somebody tears their Achilles tendon almost every year on almost every NFL team. What I believe is happening is essentially that they're specialized in their training at earlier and earlier ages, and they're stronger in more specific ways, which actually makes them more prone to injury because there's not enough diversity. So if you train, you know, one direction, one thing over and over again, you become very strong at that and very brittle at anything else. Now imagine something like climbing a tree. If you go climb a tree, you're going to experience so many angles of each joint, so many different relationships from joint to joint, so many different force vectors in relationship to the way that the force is moving through your tissues that you're going to literally becoming, you're going to be developing a strength that's much more integrated through the entire body, both on a physiological and neurological level. So that's why I'm a huge advocate of taking people into nature on a physiological level, on the level of psychologically, how you respond to nature. It's the best way, in my opinion, to make athletes who are capable in general. You might've heard this idea that, you know, farm boy strong athletes are more durable and kind of better off than weight room strong athletes.
Yeah, when my big brother started coaching down in the Keys, the first place he did, we used to go there all the time. He went right down to the docks and he found all the fishing, all the boys that have been fishermen helping their dads fish. And he's like, "You're trying out for football now."
There you go. So let's abstract that up a level and just say that's actually just a representation of human strength. Human strength is supposed to be developed by experiencing an extremely broad range of physical activities. If you need to make someone strong fast, a barbell is great. But if you want to create the most lasting, most durable, most resilient type of athlete, you want to train them in the broadest way that engages with all of the physical capacities that a human being has always needed. Because that's the way that the body is designed to move. It's the way that the body evolved to develop. And that's going to give you the strongest development. So that's what I teach people. I teach people how to go about that process in a thoughtful way, how to recognize how to dose it. That's the big problem, right? So theoretically, it's better to, say, climb trees than lift a barbell. But a barbell is very measurable, very simple, very easy.
Right. Do I climb? Today's my 7-rep tree climb day, and I do the oak tree twice and the small pine once, right?
Exactly. So now we have to start developing an intuitive sense of what's the correct amount. We have to start kind of identifying different techniques within it, start looking at how we balance these things. And nobody else, I believe, has conceptualized this in any way, the way that I've conceptualized it. So that's the natural parkour side. The other, then I also teach, you know, joint integrity and breath work and all these sort of body maintenance habits. And people who work with me as a personal trainer, I do give them some barbell training. I do give them some ring training where appropriate to close a gap in strength quickly. And then there's this aspect of what I call roughhousing. And essentially, we talked about this with the way that animals play. Every animal has this sort of agonistic combative play. And it turns out to be way bigger than just developing the ability to fight. It turns out that play is deeply intrinsically related to how we develop empathy, how we model where our body is and where another people's body is. It's the richest kind of kinesthetic source of how you map your body. It's related to dance. It's related to martial arts. It's related to essentially how we even develop a social structure at all. So I could go on and on about that. We could do a whole nother podcast just on roughhousing. But that's incredibly important. So the natural parkour and the roughhousing are the two biggest unique components to what I do. And there's very little else out there that will kind of give people an experience of doing something like what we're doing. And that, in my opinion, there's nothing else that will give you as broad a set of benefits, not just physically, but cognitively, emotionally, in your communication, as training these two things. These are the two things that, you know, you could argue that humans evolved for, that we're not engaging with, that have enormous benefits for us that are not being harvested. And I think the effects, you know, are potentially incredibly profound, because, you know, there's a research by Tracy Alloway recently just found that was significant working memory benefits that came from climbing trees. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt.
Well, simply being outside, the biological impacts, Dr. Jack Cruz's work would back you up. The idea of getting early morning sun and being exposed to that as often as possible, you know, even from that level is backed up for sure.
Get yourself out in the sun is a huge part of why it's better to train outside. Get yourself around animals. Like when I'm training, I see sea otters and ospreys and seals and sea lions and bald eagles. And every time I think to myself, man, you don't see that in the gym.
Yeah, just watch that grizzly one day, man.
Well, no grizzlies where I am, but.
Oh, all right. I'm only guessing with bald eagles and everything else.
So that's a dis- a fast description. I guess we have an hour scheduled, so I'm just kind of like rushing through it because I think we're just about out of time.
I think you're cognitively rampaging through it, man. That's the best part, because you're delivering it with what you really believe and the passion inside, man. That's what people really will be attracted to in the beginning.
So I teach the natural parkour and the roughhousing, and then the accessory practices, and then the broad principle of how you live a natural movement lifestyle, and how to. And then another aspect of what I do is I teach about the mental process, because it doesn't matter what you do, whether it's martial arts or parkour or natural movement or bowling, you run into cognitive barriers, and learning the strategies that help you overcome your fears, that help you move past plateaus, that helps everything in your life. And that's a major impact of what we do. Everything that we do, we try to draw the capacity to generalize from one thing to another. Like in we're all about being a generalist, not just as a mover, but as a human being. And the key thing is that you can't train everything. You can't train everything. So you want to train the things that make you best at the widest variety of things. And then you want to train specifically to be able to generalize from task to task. So if I get you climbing trees, what I want you to understand is how that makes you better, not just at climbing trees, but at every possible thing that it can help improve. When we roughhouse, we talk about how you can use it as a tool to become a better martial artist or deal with self-defense, of course. But we're also talking about how this helps you learn to communicate with your spouse or negotiate a business deal or whatever it is. We're always looking for how we generalize across fields and use all of our training. Every time we apply a training tool, we're trying to get the biggest effect across the broadest spectrum of capacities. And that's kind of the core principle behind what we're doing.
I'm a fan behind the idea of it giving more, because when you are processing information of the next branch, the next ledge, the next grab, even shit, I play Frisbee every other day, man. I play a pretty hardcore where we're throwing it. I mean, when you grab a 2 or 3 grain Frisbee and it's whipped, 50 yards across from you, you're catching it with all parts of your hands, you're jumping, running up the hill, you try to do something fun. I mean, and the play part of it is beautifully worked in from a biological, physiological, and human-based level, because you don't even realize what you're doing. You're kind of like, oh, that was an awesome catch, or that was close, or you almost made that one, right? And that's the part I love about it most, right, is the play and the evolving to do almost what we were built to do.
Yeah, there's research that shows that when we're engaged in a play state or a flow state, that our learning capacity increases by like 500%.
And your immune system. I mean, Stephen Kotler's been on the show here twice talking about Stealing Fire and the Rise of Superman and his journey through Lyme disease and flow state. And it heals the immune system. It does so much.
Yeah. So why not train in that way? Like, every time I train people, so one of the recent seminars, we've started with some ball games. So we play this game for basically, we create lots of different ways of like giving somebody some sort of novel demand to catch a ball. So we'll have everybody standing in a circle, and we'll have say 10 people in a circle and 8 balls moving across the circle. And you have to figure out when to catch the ball, what to pay attention to. And then we'll split it up, and we'll, you'll say be juggling 3 balls between you. And one of you guys is leading the exercise, and you keep changing how you do it. So now you're bouncing the balls off the ground. Now you're tossing them high. Now you have to stand on 1 foot. Now you have to like kneel down. The idea of that is essentially that we're just working on your ability to orient towards a new challenge, which is the fundamental capacity, really.
But well, it's also treatment for dementia, Alzheimer's, and all that stuff. It works on that end. When people are losing it to a disease, it's about playing Sudoku. It's about keeping the mind active and figuring puzzles out for sure, and working that in with how we move.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, we're generalizing across as many things. We're trying to find the best stuff that teaches you the most across as many spectrums of things as possible. But here's the interesting thing. You play that game with people, and this is a warm-up game. Everybody's smiling and laughing. Everybody's smiling and laughing by the end of playing that game for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And I always ask people, when you do your warm-up for your workout, are you smiling at the end of it? Are you laughing at the end of it? And everybody says no.
No, I'm pumped up back then, back when I lifted weights. I do all functional pattern stuff now when I'm not outside. But no, I was pissed, right? I had Metallica or something. Tool was playing on my ear, right? I'm like, I'm about to lift this shit, right? I'm angry that, walking into it. Cortisol levels through the roof. I'm emotionally out of my mind. No, you're right. I'm not, well, sometimes when I'm sparring or something like that on the bag, yeah, I get a little happy before that. But for the most part, no, man. Back then when it was lifting weights and fluorescent lightings and gyms, no, I had to hype myself up like it was pregame.
Yeah. I mean, and most people aren't even there, right? Like, you know, they're not even emotionally engaged to the point of being angry. They're just sort of walking through a process because they've been told that it's healthy for them.
Well, it's push pull day. It's Tuesday at 5 o'clock. All right. Get my curl. No, I mean, no, I mean, hey, look, if it works for you, I'm hating on
treadmill on whatever. So, but think about this. What does smiling and laughter mean?
Happiness.
Well, yes. Also means engagement with the thing that you're doing. It means that you've emptied your mind to some degree of all the stuff that you've come in with. It means that you are biohormonally triggering states that are associated with improved learning capacity.
And fitness and health and being in shape. So these are all good associations in our mind we want to connect through experiences.
So we can think of a warm-up not just as getting your blood warm or your body temperature up. We can think of a warm-up as a cognitive warm-up or an emotional warm-up too. So you can think about the way that you play, the way that you train. Is it achieving effects across all the things that it could be achieving effects? Is it getting you into the optimal state to learn and gain from what you're doing? And that, you know, I think those games that I was talking about, those are one of the best ways that you can start with that.
It's so new, but yet so ancient, what you're doing, right? Is it, we've done it since our creation, but yet to really study it maybe on a developmental level of its impact rather as something we had to do to survive. And you're kind of on the forefront, if you will, of the idea of integrating play and these mind states and trees, et cetera, of the research of it, not so much the doing it. That's the cool part of it. It's like this entwined ancient shit with a new age observational study of it. I appreciate what you're doing.
It's a balance, right? Between I'm very academically oriented. I read, you know, scientific literature. I want to understand that. I want to understand it much more deeply, but you got to recognize that there's a difference between book learning and embodied learning. And if you really want to do something about movement, you got to have both. You have to have the practical experience. It's like there's a million guys on the internet who read every piece of strength and conditioning literature who couldn't get, you know, stronger than a wet rag, right? A wet paper towel, because they don't know what their own body responds to because they haven't studied it. They haven't done the damn thing. So you got to do both. You got to do the thing and you got to understand it and you got to try and research it. And that's what we're trying to do.
And once again, we circle back to that fucking trademark. Just do it. Fucking Nike, son of a bitches. They pop up on every other podcast with the damn tagline, man.
Let's do it. Do the damn thing. I like that.
Yeah, that's better. Do the damn thing. I appreciate you coming on, man. I really do. And as you discover more, man, and have some experiments and learn some stuff and evolve with what you're doing, man, give me a call. Love to have you back on. And where are you at? Where are you based out of?
I'm based in Seattle. So if people want to come and do a private with me, I'm up here in Seattle. I offer online teaching. You can find that on my website at allmoveplay.com for the seminars. I'll have online courses available at some point this year. Lots of blogging coming up as well. Lots of content, lots of videos. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter.
Bam.
Normal stuff. Thank you very much for having me on, Adam. It was a real blast chatting with you.
Thanks. Yeah, man. That hour flew by for me, man. I was deep off in social construct, dogma, configuration, and saving our children's generation of the. I'm lost in it, man. I appreciate the conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right, buddy. Take care.
You too.
Bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have to probably inform the guest at the end that I do a little reflection at the end. I'm just realizing that we're like, all right, later, later, later. And sometimes we hang up and chat, but I like to do my reflections kind of right after it. And I love the evolution of the play outside. I am a fan of that because I grew up doing that. My grandmother would have to call me down out of the tree to come eat lunch. Sometimes I would take my lunch with me in the tree. Perhaps I am just some sort of chimp, but I found my peace there as a kid. I lived outside, hunted, hunted, fished. I grew up that way until basically the suburbs took over and everything became concrete and private lands. I was fishing all the time. We would eat lunch in the orange groves. It would either just be some grapefruit or oranges, but we stayed out until the streetlights came on and we had a good time. And that's where I still find my freedom and where I feel most healthy. And the truth being, I'm feeling guilty that I haven't fucking climbed a tree in a while, to be honest, now that I'm sitting here. It used to be one of my favorite fucking things to do. And, you know, just being outside, I think, is a beautiful thing to do. But to tap back into that child state, I think, is important. You know, I write in my book, even mentally, that when you find yourself caught up, you just go back to what a child's favorite question is and ask why. Why do I feel this way? Why am I allowing this to affect me? And find that childhood state again and be curious and not critical and observe yourself. Don't be critical and just react to yourself. That's that childhood state. If you watch children, they're so much just in the now, right? They're just hanging out right then and there, hanging out with my brother and my two nieces, Seneca and Scarlett, the other day, all weekend, really. I was watching them both just kind of be in what they were doing. And that piece of cheese was the best piece of cheese ever, right? And the chess game me and my niece were playing, that's what she was doing. And I think play gives us that and allows us to be children again and maybe remind ourselves what it's like to be human. And I can't end this podcast without giving much love to my boy Naughty Aguilar and Functional Patterns in the biomechanic work that my innovative changing little brown friend has done over his course of his life in the last decade. And a shout out to you out there, Naughty. I know you're on your spiritual walkabout, but look up Functional Patterns as well, people. They're in Seattle. Learn how to function biomechanically properly. Learn those. Stand properly. Learn to just do the basics, run and throw in a biomechanical way, in a functional pattern. And then take those resources outside and enjoy them. Take what you learn. Combine those two. Combine what works for you, but know that for many things, there's a trade-off and an imbalance. But I hope you're taking care of you. I hope you're living your cognitive rampage. I know you are. Love you.